In 2012, the last year before Swami died, in 2013, we were able to make a movie about Ananda that ended up being called Finding Happiness. If any of you haven't seen it, you should go onto the internet. You can. There's a number of movies that have the word happiness in the title, thoughts being universal. When we decided on that title, it's like several other films all came out with the same title right at the same time. So make sure it's the one about Ananda community if you want to watch it. And I had the fun, the great fun, of being involved in the production of that movie. My life path was set when I was quite young, but if it wasn't set, I think I would now go to Hollywood and make movies. I really loved everything about the process. It was really delightful. And in the end, they had to give me a title because those things are important, so I might have been called script coordinator or something like that. It was a matter of great importance when they were making the credits to the people who are making the credits that I be given a title that it was appropriate. And what my job actually was, and I was very much involved in the script, which was really an outline of individuals speaking from their hearts. Well, let me go back just to the beginning just for fun. When we were beginning to make this movie, it went through many different iterations. At the end of his life, Swami wrote a 3 or 4 movie scripts, 2 of which have been made into films. The second one besides this, was based on the path, on the new path, Meeting Master. And that film was made in India and just recently was released in India very successfully and will come over to America in February sometime, I think. But anyway, soon. It's called The Answer. And that's a complete dramatization, actors playing all the parts. The movie that we did about Ananda has one actress in it, and she's a reporter from New York who comes to see this community, and then once she arrives, everything that she sees and that happens are the people in the community playing themselves, including Swami Kriyananda. An interesting aspect of the movie, while I'm chatting about it, is even though there are hundreds, thousands of hours of Swami Kriyananda standing up in front of a microphone, holding forth in a discourse or doing classes or so on like that, there's very little film of him just being himself. At the end of his life, when Brian McSweeney was traveling with him, he did run the camera a certain amount just when they were having tea and things like this. But the only other place where you really see it is in this movie, where he's relaxed and interacting with people. Swami had written a script for the film, like to tell the story of Ananda. And when the professional director, Ted Nicolau, came to Ananda Village to begin to work on the filming, which would have been either 2012 or 2011, he was looking for one person to host the reporter and take her around, and that was a main role. And also just he wanted to see how we'd do. So he handed people the scripts, and he had auditions, and people were reading. Afterwards, he came to Swami, and he said, "Your people are terrible reading from a script." He said, "But when I take the script away and just let them speak from their hearts, they're wonderful." And Swami said, "Oh, I have no intention of speaking from the script." He said, "There's no reason they should either." Which suddenly put us in the position where we had an outline but an unscripted film. And just now I'm telling the whole story of Finding Happiness, so I'll go on with it. Shivani Lucky, who lives in Assisi, was the executive producer. And when she came to America to start the filming, I had been trying to get into this film, you know, get involved in the making of this film for years, and no door opened for me. It was just sheer enthusiasm. I really wanted to be part of it. I didn't realize that Shivani had me in her pocket the whole time. She just never told me. So when she came to visit to work with us, we decided we would have a play date. And Shivani's a very serious person, so even the idea that we would have a play date was peculiar, but we were going to have a play date. And our play date turned out to be that I come downstairs and she's laid the whole script out on the table, and we're going to go over it page by page. And we sat at that table for about 8 days, actually, and used Swamiji's script to tell us what he thought was important to say about Ananda, but not necessarily the words. We wouldn't use those words because people were too stilted when they were using his words. So by the time we went to make the movie, my job really was authenticity, accuracy, and to help people, because it cost us, I don't know what it cost us, how many thousands of dollars per minute to film, because we were filming like a feature film. A documentary is just one guy with a camera, but we filmed like a feature film with, you know, so 1 inch outside of the frame, you've got a dozen people who are all getting union wages, you know. So we didn't have time for people to ramble, as you do in a documentary. So my job was to speak to people in advance, to hone their intention, to help make sure that they said what was important in the bigger picture, etc. Now, why did I even bring this up? I knew I have a very good reason. And I, oh, yes, and I will come to it. Part of any presentation of Ananda, at least from my point of view, is Swami's music, because he himself speaks so forcefully about the importance of it in terms of it keeping Ananda in tune. And it really is, if you begin to travel internationally, and because now our congregation is so mixed, traveling internationally for some of you means coming here and not going there. And you go all over the world now with Ananda, and everywhere you go, people are singing the same music, not always in the same language, singing Master's chants. I remember in 1982, which was the first time I ever went abroad, had a passport and used it. And I only speak English now and then. And Ananda in Europe, where we were, Italy, was very undeveloped. Now we have a beautiful retreat center, but then it was just a groups of devotees here and there. And these devotees from Pisa had acquired some old hotel, which was way out somewhere out there. I have no idea where it was, because I was just put in the back seat of a car with people who didn't speak English, and so we were just carried. So we're in the back seat of this car, going from the city of Pisa, driving 3 or 4 hours to somewhere, with our host trying to explain to us in Italian the sights, which was entertaining but not very helpful. We finally get to some place, who knows where, some broken down hotel. We go through here, we go through there. We literally had to bend over and sort of go through slight construction zones and all of that to get to this little chapel where they're singing Door of My Heart in Italian. And all these same pictures of the masters are up there. And this is my first trip out of America. And it's only 1982. And it brings tears to my eyes just to think about it. It's like distance, difference, language, strangeness. You know, of course I recognized the melody and could intuit the words easily. Italian sounds enough familiar that I could hear it. It's like this is such a strange reality that we're all living. Just because I'm randomly wandering around, I'll give you another one of those examples. This was in New Delhi. We were in the apartment of a friend. He's Indian, as it happens. His wife was Tibetan, but that was just an incidental mix. In the room are Americans. I think there was a few Germans, Italians, Indians, this Tibetan woman, maybe somebody from Nepal, I don't remember. A mixed group, maybe 15 of us. It was one of the times that America had just gone to war with someone, as one of my Indian friends said to me, which was startling because you live in your own culture and you don't think about it. He just sort of said, oh, you Americans, you're always at war with someone. He said it just like that. And I thought, huh, I think that is true. Well, we were at war with someone. It might have been Yugoslavia. Did we bomb in Yugoslavia at one point? I think it was the Croatian, Bosnia, all that breaking up. But anyway, American bombers were going out from somewhere in Europe, I think, going out, dropping bombs, going back. My Indian friend, as it happened, his job, very high-level job, was at the airport at New Delhi, and his job was the chief safety officer. No plane ever took off from that airport without his approval. And at some point in the process, he was in the air on whatever strata his plane was moving on, and the American bombers were moving back and forth below. So they were going out like this and dropping bombs, and then they were coming back empty and going back to where they were, like this. And he's up above, just watching them. And then we're all in the room here. I think it was that war, because during that war, a lot of those people fled to Assisi. And we had to take in our community, we had to take in a lot of devotees from the countries that were fighting each other, but there they all were just in Assisi, and nobody wanted to have anything to do with this. So we're sitting there realizing just how, as Master writes in Autobiography of a Yogi, you know, race wars, sectarian prejudice, insane nationalism, this is, Babaji and Jesus are very concerned about all of this. And they've planned the salvation of this age, which is not politics, but Kriya Yoga, where we all can feel in our hearts that this is just meaningless. This is greed and selfishness and evil that has to be stopped. I'm not a pacifist. You know, Master himself said, bullies have to be stopped. It's not spiritual just to stand there and let evil have its day. Master himself said, he put into the mind of Harry Truman the idea of going to war in North Korea to stop the communist incursion into that peninsula. How about that? Master himself was William the Conqueror. He was a general in Spain, Fernando III spent his entire life in war, and William the Conqueror spent much of his life in war. So it's not like there's never a time when physical force is needed. But there's also a completely other reality. And sitting in this living room, and our friend is just talking about this experience, and you know, I'm seeing America from a wholly different perspective. By this time, I've traveled a great deal, because this happened much more recently. I wasn't as naive as I was when I went to Italy in 1981. But we made a decision that someday there will be a passport. And the passport will be issued by the nation of self-realization. And you'll have the opportunity to choose that passport. And the other people can use whatever they want, but that's the one that we'll use. Because that really is our identity, and in a wholly different way. Now I'm going to go back. I'm actually finding the threads. They're all there. I'm going to go back to the Finding Happiness movie. Okay? In the Finding Happiness movie, we had to work hard on the visual look. Because especially in that rural community, we're very, very casual. And we were also trying very hard to make Ananda look multi-generational, because all the founding members have aged in place. We might have aged graciously, but we've aged in place. And we didn't really want Ananda to look like the last remnant of a great community, you know. We wanted it to have some youthful vitality. So there was this tremendous effort at all times to make sure that different ages were represented. But whenever we had a crowd scene, our objective cameraman and so on would keep telling us that, you know, the diversity wasn't there, the age diversity wasn't there. You know, and since my job was the details, I'd look and I'd count and I'd say, yes, it is there, I can see it. But when I started really looking, and also when I looked around at the young Hollywood crew that was helping us, you know, the makeup artists and the grip, you know, and all the wardrobe people like that, I realized that what had happened within Ananda is that generation is not just seen on the face, but generation is the accoutrements that go around it. The blue hair, the tattoo, the little whatever costume, you know, the shoes, all of that stuff, which was largely non-existent. And so that when you just glanced at a group, they tended to look, they didn't look hip, you know? Because from most people's standards, they weren't, you know? And one woman finally came in. She had this beautiful tattoos all over her back, down her arm. Most of the time, most of the people in the community didn't see it. And she was sort of a rebellious type. And she knew that that wasn't the Ananda style, but she came in for the filming in a tank top with this, you know, incredible display on her back. So you've got all these people, and then you've got Wham, her like this. The cameraman come to me like, you know, should we have her put on a sweater? I said, no, for God's sake, somebody has a tattoo. You know? Like, zoom in on her, for heaven's sakes. And fortunately, they were beautiful. In fact, it just passes over lightly when I finally look at the film. But we were always playing this with the, with the professional crew, because they didn't want us. When we had hired them, but they were advising us. We were working together. We didn't want to make something that would be a joke. It needed to be authentic, but it also needed to be appropriate for what we were trying to do. So the issue of the music was always an issue, because innocent is putting it mildly to describe what our music is like. And just as time passes, the way we sing, quite apart from the chants, which is its own genre, but all of the songs that we sing, the words that we sing, I mean, today was just perfect. I couldn't have asked you to sing better. There's joy in the heavens, a smile on the mountain, melody sings everywhere. It like seems so natural to us. It isn't very hip. Is hip even the right word? Swami Kriyananda said he referred to boogie-woogie. And someone finally corrected him and told him that the word for him then was rock and roll. And he was surprised, because the last time he checked, it was boogie-woogie. you don't want to become old in a way that people whisper behind your back. You become old because you can't help it, but otherwise. But in any case, the music was absolutely central, because music is language. And even more powerfully, music is vibration. Swami said that the original Christian church was held together by the Gregorian chant, because the vibration of the Gregorian chant was exactly the vibration of what they were trying to do. And so when they would all come back into their monasteries and sing that repeatedly, it aligned them energetically. You see, vibratory energy comes first, and then comes the expression. We're always acting according to what we're in tune with. And Swami speaks about the incredible and extraordinary importance of music, as it not only reflects consciousness, it creates consciousness. So you become the music that you listen to, because it's not an intellectual idea. It's om. It's closer to om than words. Words are symbols of intellectual ideas. And when we say words to each other, if I say home, if I say love, if I say father, mother, brother, God, we all have associations with those words, and we immediately interpret those words according to how we understand it. And so the word vibration becomes a symbol. But music is not a symbol. Music is a vibration. We are om. We are made of the vibration of om. All of creation is made of the vibration of om. That's why music affects us so differently. That's why these fascinating experiences of people who've had Alzheimer's for years and are completely out of touch and can't communicate. And if you play the music that was important to them when they were young, they remember the words. I mean, there's wonderful stories told of people who haven't uttered a sound in years will be singing along. Because it touches something that's very, very different in there. Let's see, there was a thought. Well, I can't remember it at the moment. But in any case, so this tremendous importance of the music says something. And so if you use a piece of music, it is like speaking and explaining what your visual images are about. So Ted, who was our director, he was just wonderful. He was totally able to be in both worlds at the same time. He really understood us. He was a joy, is a joy, and was a joy to work with. Others of them sort of came in through him, but they weren't quite as much on our side. So this one, I can't remember what his role was. It was significant. We start this conversation. He absolutely insists that we cannot use Swami's music as the soundtrack, that we must use something that is more modern, that people will respond to, that isn't so much like this. He starts this conversation. We're listening to him, Shivani and I. Finally, I said, this is a total waste of time. There is not you know, what did they say, an Ice Cube's chance in hell that we're going to use any music but Swami's for the soundtrack to this. So explain to me what's wrong with it, and we'll do our very best to bridge the difficulty. And then, in fact, David Eby, with a professional soundtrack musician, they created a soundtrack out of the melodies, which was the perfect solution. Even if it wasn't, it was what we were going to do. But still, we had these scenes where, and this was the visual, we had the choir standing up, and it's always a little difficult for us to figure out how to dress as a group. So they had these dresses that, I was actually responsible for that particular costume. It was not one of my better ideas. But they modified it with scarves and everything, and they looked pretty nice, and the men had bright shirts on, and they're standing under this canopy. It was all really gorgeous, and they're singing. And they sang a lot of the songs. And the first round of the movie, there was a lot of picture of the choir. So I go down for the director's cut, which is, these are terms of art, you know, I go down for the director's cut. I had so much fun. I was picked up. I was alone. As it happened, I was the only person at Ananda who was free to go to the first screening. We actually had a focus. No, it wasn't the first screening. This is wrong. This was when a focus group watched it. We had a focus group watching it to respond. I was the only one from Ananda who was able to go. So I go alone. I'm picked up in a taxi. The taxi driver doesn't give a damn, but I love saying, I'm here in L.A. to look at a film we've just finished. He was like not impressed, but I was really impressed. So we go to this focus group meeting, and there's this special filming. It was good. It was all very helpful. They give you feedback later. The next morning I meet with the publicity people and Ted and a couple of others, you know, and they're all hip. They were very hip. Very, very hip. And so we're talking about what's good and bad about the movie, and I could see it too. Way too much footage of the choir singing, quite apart from the quality of the music. They were interesting, but not that interesting. It just couldn't go on and on like it did. So, you know, I get along pretty well with these people. They like me. And it was like, since I was alone, I was the only one there, it's like one of the guys says to me, do you all really do that? I said, you mean dress up in rainbow colors and sing those songs? Uh-huh. Yeah, we do it all the time. And it was just like, he just had no idea what to do with it. Absolutely none. I mean, it was a job. He was going to help us. He could see that it was a quality film, but it was just like, you know, you couldn't pay me enough to dress up in rainbow colors and sing, there's joy in the heaven. But that is actually who we are, you know? It's who we are on a very, very deep level. And there is just this quality about the spiritual path. And now we're coming all the way back around to suffer little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. And what is it really that he's talking about? Because, you know, children are not competent in many ways. I was watching little Giselle. When the energy goes up a child's spine, he just does this. You know, he doesn't know what else to do with it. I don't know what was inspiring Giselle. Partly it was because her shoes lit up every time she jumped. Giselle is about this big. But, you know, she was just standing there. Children do just for quite a long time. And it's like, they feel it. Swami says, literally, they feel the kundalini going up, and they just don't know what to do with it. And, of course, by the same token, and I'm not going to demonstrate this one, a child, you know, something goes wrong and the child hurls himself to the floor. You know, the energy goes down and he falls like that. Because it's just all swirling and they really don't quite know what to do with it. Now, that's not the kind of childlike that's being asked. But what's really being asked of us spiritually is what is real and who do I really want to be? You know, you see all these people who are so shrewd and, you know, so self-serving, and they're so thinking about it, and they're always analyzing it. I mean, like, is that really who we want to be? And the saints become so just free, just so easy and free, but perfectly appropriate. You see, there's the freedom that is because you're too dumb to know that you're making a fool of yourself. And then there's that middle school, which is really what it is, that middle school where you're always looking around. I remember a friend, a serious Ananda friend, a lovely person, when we were I was trying to understand certain reactions of his, which were a little incomprehensible to me. And then he very honestly said, it's very important to me that I always appear to be smart and sharp and knowing what's going on. Shrewd was actually even the word he came to. You know, where does that come from? I mean, that's an American quality. The thing about speaking to American audiences, which now that I've had some experience, especially in India, is so different, is, you know, Americans have a lot of heart. And when I would, which I have done a great deal, introduced an American audience to this whole spiritual path, very often people just go right with it. But then they go home and they think about it, you know, and they begin to wonder, you know, if maybe there was something there that they didn't really see, like that. Because it's very important in America to be shrewd. And the last thing you ever want to appear to be is to be credulous or foolish. You know, it's just our value system. Italians just go right from the heart. And Indians have intuition. They see spirituality, they just rush to it. It doesn't cross their mind not to. One of the first times I was in India giving a class for Ananda. And maybe when it was after I spoke. Now, because I have so much on the internet, I go places and people know me before I get there. But I think after I spoke, there was this group of Indian women surrounding me. Just lovely people, ordinary, regular, lovely people. And they were so inspired by what had happened. Really, it was hard for me to stand up because they were just loving me so much. You know, just, but not like Jesus Christ has arrived in our midst. It was just, they really enjoyed what happened, and there was just complete lack of inhibition in just giving me their hearts. And I thought, this is what it is. Every country has something to offer. It's not, America has tremendous qualities that the world is really absorbing, of freedom, of initiative, of creativity, of determination, of willpower, of imagination, I mean, of skill in the material world. That's why Master came here to start this work. But we're childish, but we're not always childlike, because we don't trust our hearts enough. And that's why Swami has this thing, there's joy in the heavens, a smile on the mountain. Why would we not want to sing like that? And you have to ask yourself, really, what is holding me back from singing this? You know, you fill my heart with music. I dance through life with thee. You know, there are messages here. And the spiritual path is this very careful balance between authenticity and sincerity. We really don't get anywhere by trying to figure out what it's supposed to look like and then trying to make it look like that. I've been in this family now for 45 years, and I've seen the result of many different alternatives. And this is who I'm supposed to be, this is the dress I'll put on, that one doesn't work. Nor does the, I'm determined to be myself, that one doesn't work either. The one that works is childlike openness, just what Swami said today, with a little touch of discrimination. You know, what is the highest truth here? Where am I trying to go? And there it is, and here I am. And so there's no point in pretending there's not a gap. There's no point in pretending alone in my car I'm not going to put on a different recording than the joy singers dressed in rainbow colors, you know. There's no point in pretending. But for our own future on the spiritual path, don't defend either. You know, we are childlike. We are innocent. We are an embarrassment to hip people. We just are. That's just the way it is. And we should be proud of that. You know, no, we don't believe in it. No, Boogie Woogie went out a long time ago. You know, and I may not know that. But in the eyes of God, what really matters? What really matters is the goodness of our hearts, the courage of our commitment, the power of our love. And let all the other waves of our own lives come and go and come and go and come and go. Recently, friends were involved in big life-changing things that seemed so important. And I thought, yeah, you know, when I had to make all those same decisions, they seemed really important to me too. But in fact, none of it makes any difference. The only thing that matters is the heart open to God. Suffer little children to come unto me, for of such are the kingdom of heaven. Really feel that as deeply as you can possibly feel it. And ask Divine Mother, as a child would ask its mother, guide me, bless me, awaken me.